has three children, two sons, and a daughter. Dr. Root holds a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in mathematics from California Polytechnic State University. He also holds a Master of Divinity and a Doctor of Philosophy degree from Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, where he has taught since 1972. He is currently professor of Hebrew and Old Testament interpretation, instructing in both seminary and the undergraduate school. Dr. Rue's interest in the war for Southern independence began in his youth and has led him over the years to extensive study and research. He is Lieutenant Commander of the 16th Regiment, South Carolina Volunteers, Sons of Confederate Veterans, Camp 36. He is committed to accurate propagation of the war history and the Southern cause. His special interest is the religious aspects of the war. He currently serves as state chaplain for the South Carolina Division of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. So if you would, please welcome Dr. Root as he comes and presents his first program, The Cause of the South.
In 1955, Clifford Doughty, in his History of the Confederacy, had this to say: "By now a whole secular priesthood has arisen to assume authority for the dogmas of the interpretation of the war." That was 1955. Doughty was already complaining that historians, usually northern in their roots and their orientation, had come about to try to establish what the war was about and to make statements that would govern the thinking of history teachers in our nation about the war. Perhaps today, in the 80s and on into the 90s, the high priest of this secular priesthood is James M. McPherson, with his Battle Cry of Freedom, published in 1988, in which he says, "Although the speeches and editorials in the South bristled with references to rights, liberty, state sovereignty, honor, resistance to coercion, and identity with Southern brothers, such rhetoric could not conceal the fundamental issue of slavery." On the next page, he gives perhaps his clearest belittling statement of the South and its cause: "The Upper South, like the Lower, went to war to defend the freedom of white men to own slaves and to take them into the territories as they saw fit." He quotes Jefferson Davis: "From the highest and solemn motive of defending and protecting the rights which our fathers bequeathed us, let us renew such sacrifices as our fathers made to the holy cause of constitutional liberty." And after quoting those words from Davis, then McPherson mocks Davis with these words: "What were these rights and liberties for which Confederates contended? The right to own slaves, the liberty to take this property into the territories. I grow disgusted and weary at such words, but even though I would claim that James M. McPherson is perhaps the high priest of that secular priesthood, he's run a close second by the popular Ken Burns because of the PBS series that aired in my state in South Carolina in December of 1990. A lady from Virginia, an elderly lady named Mrs. Claude Huffman, wrote a letter in April of 1991 protesting that Burns' series wasn't actually balanced and really didn't give the charity towards the South that he had claimed that it did. And I read the letter. I read a copy of it. It was a gracious letter. She's an elderly lady, and she's wise, and certainly a lady to be sure. And then she let me see the response that Burns wrote back, and Burns was caustic. He said to her, "Southerners are deluding themselves by not admitting that the cause of the war was slavery, that is, the preservation of that hateful institution. I am sorry that you were so blinded by your hate that you could not see the simple message of peace and reconciliation in our series." And that effeminate-looking little Yankee with a pixie hairdo so accosted this Southern lady, disgusting beyond measure. And I submit to you, it's time that we answer the charges of that secular priesthood that Clifford Doughty could recognize even in 1955, in those days of conservatism characterized by the Eisenhower administration. So let's consider, as we address the cause of the South, the charge of the South's fighting for slavery. I want to share with you a couple testimonials from onlookers. These are both black professors. The first one is John Hope Franklin, professor emeritus of history from Duke University, North Carolina. In the educational TV series that came out in the late 80s, I noted, and I kept replaying the tape until I could get this down verbatim, these words from Dr. Franklin. Northerners began not only to condemn the institution of slavery, which Southerners might concede, but they began also to condemn the slaveholders as men of no principle, as men that were themselves immoral, as men who were themselves unchristian, and then Dr. Franklin says, etc., etc. So that slaveholders who might have conceded that there was something wrong about the institution of slavery might have said that in the long run perhaps we ought to get rid of it, would not concede that they themselves were the bad guys, that the Northerners began to insist that they were. So they determined, therefore, to resist the Northern attitudes and positions with respect to slavery, and with all the resources and all the vigors they could summon, and they did. And there's a black man who has his head screwed on straight, at least with regard to recognizing that it was really the insistence of abolitionists and their mania that caused the Southerners to defend their rights. And let me supplement that with the statement from Edward C. Smith, black college professor from American University. I think that if you look at the Civil War from the standpoint of the popular movie Glory, and from the viewpoint of the Ken Burns Civil War presentation, they present it as a moral crusade. And of course, that is not true. Burns' purpose was to prove that the war was fought for the emancipation of the slaves. And that is not true. Now, let's look at the testimony of men who were there. Not 20th century historians, but men who were there. Let me share with you Robert Stiles. Stiles was a lieutenant of artillery in the Richmond Howitzers. His dad was J.C. Stiles, 70 years old, a revivalist minister whom Jackson brought to his camp after Antietam in September of 62. Great godly man. Stiles says in his volume, "What now of the essential spirit of these young volunteers? Why did they volunteer? For what did they give their lives? We can never appreciate the story of their deeds as soldiers until we address this question correctly. Surely it was not for slavery they fought. The great majority of them had never owned a slave and had little or no interest in the institution. My own father, for example, had freed his slaves long before the war. The great conflict will never be properly comprehended by the man who looks upon it as a war to preserve slavery." John Wise, son of the Governor Wise, who was governor just right before the war, the governor of Virginia. Wise was a young man at VMI and fought in the Battle of New Market in 1864. He hated slavery. In his book, published in 1901, he notes, "It was a curse, and nobody knows better than I the terrible abuses that were possible and actual under the system. Thank God it is gone." And I could go on, but that's adequate. Now, who is insane enough to say that young Wise, as a cadet, would fight to preserve the institution he openly admits he hated? He blamed slavery for killing his mother. They had 40 slaves. He said his mother was worked into an early grave by her tender care for those blacks, staying up long hours with them when they were sick, helping the old black women sew, hauling them on in to town to get clothes. And he talks about the compassion and the love that the family had for those blacks. But he despised slavery because it robbed him as a young man from his mother. Lieutenant Theodore F. Davidson, lieutenant in the 39th North Carolina, he survived the war and wrote the history of that unit. He talks about the ardor with which the non-slaveholding portions of the population flew to arms at the call of their respective states. He observes, and I quote, "From the eastern foothills of the Blue Ridge," this is in North Carolina, "to the western boundaries of Clay and Cherokee, the slave owners in 1861 were so rare that the institution of slavery may be said practically to have had no existence. And yet, that region sent more than 15,000 fighting men, volunteers, into the field." He goes on, and I quote again, "It will be perhaps many years beyond the generations now living before the popular delusion that the war between the states had its origin in the existence of Negro slavery will be dispelled. Only a fool would argue that Lieutenant Davidson fought to preserve the hateful institution," as Burns worded it, "of slavery." What about the leaders? There's a copy back here of Marianna Jackson's 1895 memoirs, The Stonewall. That's the second edition. The first edition came out in 92 or 93, and this one's a better edition in that she supplements the first edition with about 200 pages of testimonials from men who served under General Jackson. But in that volume, on pages 142 and 143, she says, "It has been said that General Jackson fought for slavery and the Southern Confederacy with the unshaken conviction that both were to endure. I am very confident that he would never have fought for the sole object of perpetuating slavery. It was for her constitutional rights that the South resisted the North, and slavery was only comprehended within those rights. He," she's speaking of her husband, "he found the institution a responsible and troublesome one, and I have heard him say that he would prefer to see the Negroes free." So did Jackson, contrary to his wife's own testimonial, fight to preserve, as Burns worded it, the hateful institution of slavery? Is Mrs. Jackson deluding herself? Are Southerners deluding themselves, as Burns worded it, by not admitting that the war was fought for slavery? Shall I read and believe Ken Burns and James N. McPherson about why Stonewall Jackson fought in that war? Or shall I read and believe his wife? You be the judge. Robert E. Lee. J. William Jones was one of his chaplains at Washington University, later Washington Lee University, after the war. During the war, Jones was chaplain of the 13th Virginia. But he notes that Lee had said, if the 4 million slaves in the South had belonged to him, he would gladly free them with the stroke of a pen to preserve the Union. Douglas Southall Freeman, in his 4-volume Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Lee, we have the abridgment back here on the shelf, and that's an excellent volume, beautiful volume. Is that in your things, Brother Baker? And it's fine, and if you have a problem with an abridgment, the Harwell, who abridged that, is an excellent scholar, and the words, except for a few little transitional phrases here and there, the words are virtually all Freeman. And that's a little chunk of gold. The bigger chunk of gold is the 4-volume set. You're going to hurt your finances if you buy that. I was given to it in the Lord's providence. I praise the Lord for it. I prize it. I have the 1936 Pulitzer Prize-winning edition, the first time all 4 volumes were published in 1 year. The first two came out in 34, the next in 35. But Freeman notes that Lee was for the forbearance to the last, recognizing no necessity to the recourse to arms. The maintenance, Freeman says, of slavery meant nothing to Lee. He felt that if he owned all the slaves in the South, he would cheerfully give them up to preserve the Union. Lee's son, Robert Jr., in his biography of his dad, quotes a man, an Englishman, that had an interview with Lee after the war, And the man said, on the subject of slavery, he assured me that he had always been in favor of the emancipation of the Negroes, and that in Virginia, the feeling had been strongly inclined in the same direction until the ill-judged enthusiasm amounting to rancor of the abolitionists in the North had turned the Southern tide in the other direction. And again, that I'm citing a source that hangs the cause of the war on what I call abolitionist mania. For the most part, propagated and given momentum by the Unitarian liberals and a lot of the Methodist liberals in the North in those days prior to the war. Lee wrote three letters on the day he resigned his commission, the 20th of April in 1861, and in all three of those letters he makes a statement that he would draw his sword again in no cause except for, and I quote, the defense of my native state, the defense of Virginia. Lee had a conversation in 1869 with a pastor, John Layburn, in Baltimore. Layburn was trying to get him to go to New York and solicit funds from the great inventor, Cyrus McCormick, funds to help Lee University, well, Washington University, today Washington Lee University. And Layburn recorded the conversation that took place in Baltimore, and Douglas Houghton Freeman passes that on. He notes, Freeman is an incredible scholar. I have very high respect for Freeman. I don't think he knew the Lord. That grieves me. But his scholarship is virtually impeccable, according to what I can see. And he notes that on everything Layburn wrote, where we can check it out from other sources, he hit the bullseye. And Freeman argues there is no reason whatever to doubt the authenticity of what I'm about to relate to you, this interview with Lee in 1869. Let me quote in part. Then the conversation turned to the attitude of the Northern press, Layburn says. Lee expressed his regret that the Northern papers continued to assert that the object of the war had been to perpetuate slavery. On this point, he seemed not only indignant, but hurt. He said it was not true. He declared that for himself he had emancipated most of his slaves years before the war, and that he had sent to Liberia those that were willing to go. The latter were writing most affectionate letters to him, some of which he had received through the lines during the war. Lee's response to the allegation, the assertion that the war was fought by the Southerners to perpetuate slavery, well, as Layburn quotes it, Lee said, "It is not true. Shall I therefore believe Lee? Shall I believe Jackson's wife? Shall I believe these young men like Wise and Stiles and Theodore Davidson who actually fought in Southern units? Or shall I believe the high priest of the modern secular priesthood, James Eck McPherson, Ken Burns, and the like? I think we've answered the charge that the South fought to perpetuate slavery. It's simply a matter of who you're going to believe. Shall you believe the modern secular priesthood or believe the Southern men that laid down their lives or were willing to lay down their lives and in the providence of an almighty God survived the war?" There's another charge that I want to answer, the charge that the South was wrong to secede. Have you heard that? Well, let me affirm that the South was legally right to secede, that the South had in constitutional law in this country the legal right to do what it did. The original states had cautiously recognized the potential of the federal government to exceed the limited constitutional powers that were granted it by the Constitution and to encroach upon powers that were denied to it. And so these original states ratified the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, as a provision to guard against such encroachment. Now let me read to you the 10th of the 10 amendments, the climactic, until, you know, later when other amendments came, the last thing about the Constitution, the last impact that it has on its reader, on its hearer. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited to the people, prohibited to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. Again, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. Now, note, the Constitution makes no provision to prevent states from seceding. The Constitution makes no provision for the executive branch or for any branch to maintain the unity of the Union. The powers not specified explicitly belonged to the states and even northern states as early as the early 1800s, the early 19th century, were threatening to secede for various reasons and various causes that irritated them. In modern times, H. Newcomb Morris, in 1986 in the Stetson Law Review, has published an article, The Foundations and Meaning of Secession. He argues, 1986, the legality of secession in that period before the war between the states. Lincoln himself, in his address to Congress in 1848, says these words. You can read these words in Basler's Collected Works of Lincoln and other well-known works. Any people whereby, being inclined and having the power, have the right to rise up and shake off the existing government and to form a new one that suits them better. This is a most valuable, a most sacred right, a right which we hope and believe is to liberate the world. Nor is this right confined to cases in which the whole people of an existing government may choose to exercise it. Any portion of such people that can may revolutionize and make their own of so much of the territory as they inhabit. The gist of that statement, Lincoln says that the right to rebel, to throw off a government, is an inherent right. He contradicted himself years later. This was his speech in 1848. So I say to you, even the man Lincoln was recognizing the legality of it in spite of what he had to say later on. Modern legal scholars recognize the legality of it. Common sense argues for the legality of it as you interpret the nature of the Bill of Rights, especially the Tenth Amendment. The South had the legal right to do what he did, to do what it did, and we will not tolerate the charge that the South was wrong to secede. What about moral right and wrong? If it was legally right, what about moral? Well, wasn't it morally wrong for the South to secede? Let's talk about the commercial North as contrasted with the rural South in the decades before the war. By the end of the 1850s, the northern states contained 4/5 of all the factories in our land, 2/3 of the railroad mileage, practically all of the shipyards. Many of the plantations thrived on rice and tobacco and other cash crops, but cotton more and more was taking over to meet the need and the demand of the market of the northern Yankee textile mills and the mills in England, especially England. So the dependency of southern economy on cotton became obvious. The output of cotton in 1849 was 2 million bales. A decade later, in 1859, it had grown to 5.7, almost 6 million bales. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that constituted 7/8 of the world's cotton, and it was over half of all the exports from this country. And the government had been enabled by the Yankee influence in the Senate and in the Congress to pass tariffs that were very high, and it caused Southerners to have to spend an incredible amount of money to buy the tools and things they needed to work their fields from imported sources, especially England, and it was forcing them, therefore, to buy them from the North. So the Southern economy had become inherently dependent on slavery. And it was the abolitionist mania of the North, under the guise of humanitarianism, arguing that the South must liberate its slaves. So the South was doing what it had to do morally to stay alive economically. After all, there's a principle that a man who does not provide for his own house is worse than an infidel. Would we be wrong to generalize that principle and say that a nation that does not provide for the stability of its economy is infidelish in its orientation? But because of the influence of the Northerners, under the heat and the momentum of abolitionism, the air became filled with the guise and the claim that slavery was inherently evil. And let me talk about one of the great apostles of abolitionism, John Brown, who in Kansas in 1856 at Pottawatomie Creek, under the name of religion and in the name of God, went to James Doyle's home. Doyle was arguing that Kansas ought to have the right to decide for itself if it should be slave or free. And in the middle of the night, he took Doyle and three of his sons. His wife clamored for the life of the youngest, who was 14, but Doyle and the two older sons were taken out. And I want to read what William Davis, in that first volume, Brother Against Brother, of the Time Life series, that gray series that used to show up everywhere, and I don't like it because it's so northern biased, but listen to what Davis has to say about this incident, May 24, 1856. Out on the prairie, the visitors cut down and killed James Doyle with their swords. By the way, they drug him out of bed in the middle of the night. They split his son's skulls like melons. They sliced the arms off of the corpses. They kept on hacking at the bloody bodies for a while, and then they departed to the litany and the wails of Mrs. Doyle. John Brown had come to call. Julia Ward Howe honored Brown. The author of the Battle Hymn of the Republic honored Brown when he returned back to Virginia. The man was a maniac. The man was a satanic instrument. The man was infamous. But the Unitarian Julia Ward Howe, wife of Dr. Howe, the famous Unitarian liberal, honored this maniac. His thinking was characteristic of the abolitionist mania that Lee called rancor. And that, my friends, was the motivating fire that justified morally what the Southerners did. They legally had the right to secede. They morally had the right to protect their economy and to protect themselves from maniacs like John Brown. I affirm the charge that the South was wrong to secede from the Union, the United States of America, is morally and legally preposterous. They had every right to do what they did. There's another charge. What about the South firing on Sumter? It's alleged that the South fired on Sumter, and they started the war. And Sherman's soldiers breathed fire all the way as they marched on down from Savannah, Georgia, and then swung around and came on up to Columbia, South Carolina, the capital of my home state now. So let's address this question. Was the South unreasonable? Was it wrong? Can we charge that? Can we tolerate that charge? Doubleday, who was a captain at that time, later the Yankee General Doubleday, was Major Anderson's right-hand man. Anderson was the Yankee commander that first was at Fort Moultrie and later at Fort Sumter. Fort Moultrie is on the edge of Charleston Harbor. But Doubleday wrote after the war in Battles and Leaders, as he commented on Anderson's moving the day after Christmas in 1860, on the 20th of December, South Carolina seceded, the first state to secede, and the day after Christmas, when he could do it inconspicuously in the middle of the night, then Anderson moved his men from Fort Moultrie to Fort Sumter. And Doubleday commented about that later in Battles and Leaders, and he says, "The order to move from Fort Moultrie to Sumter was startling and unexpected. I thought of the immediate hostilities which the movement would be the occasion. So Doubleday is admitting that Anderson's move occasioned the hostilities. Now, what happened? Well, the Southerners graciously provided food for Anderson and his men until the 7th of April. Sumter was leveled by Beauregard and the Southerners on the 12th, early 4:30 in the morning, on the 12th of April. And what was going on is, we had three liaisons that were trying to get an audience with Lincoln. He wouldn't hear them. They finally ended up going through Supreme Court Justice Campbell, and, you know, they were in frustration trying to do what they could to get Fort Sumter, arguing that although it's a man-made fort, it's Southern soil, South Carolina soil, the state of South Carolina owned it inherently, and there's no way that the state could protect itself without having access to that fort. The South, having seceded previously on the 20th of December of 1860, was arguing, therefore, that the fort should be relinquished. Now, Lincoln commissioned Gustavus Fox to come down and search out a plan. The plan began to be executed on the 6th of April in 1861. Lincoln ordered the largest fleet in the history of humanity to sail from New York Harbor and to come, I quote, resupply the food of these starving soldiers at Fort Sumter, a provisioning expedition, a provisioning fleet. On July 4th of that year, in his speech to Congress, Lincoln bombasted the South. He attacked and bombarded for attacking and bombard. He attacked and bombarded the South for attacking and bombarding Fort Sumter, and I quote now, without even awaiting the arrival of the provisioning exposition. Well, first of all, I've got to ask, why did they need to be provided for when they were well provided for? On one occasion, Anderson turned back 300 pounds of beef because he didn't like some way about how the Southerners had sent it out there. And the fleet was ordered on the 6th of April. The spies, the Confederate spies, recognizing something big was going down, informed Beauregard and Governor Pickens, and so the next day they stopped letting the fort get food from the people in Charleston. Now, let me share with you what actually went there. The Baltic, Gustavus Fox command ship, had 200 soldiers on it. It had food supplies, indeed. You know, the ability of the politicians to lie and deceive and cover up is not a new thing with regard to modern times and Slick Willie's administration. It had food, but it had 200 soldiers. 200 soldiers, food provisions. There was a five-gun cutter and three war steamers. The five-gun cutter was the Harriet Lane. It had one 8-inch gun and four 32-pounders. The three war steamers were the Pawnee, Pocahontas, and Powhatan. The Pawnee had 8 9-inch guns. The Pocahontas was very heavily armed. The Powhatan was an 11-gun flagship. It had an 11-inch cannon, 10 9-inch cannon. It had 300 sailors. In all, therefore, there were 500 men, tugs, to lead these ships into the fort. I submit to you, these sound like strange food provisions for human beings to eat. It was a guise. It was a feint. Lincoln had hoped to sneak these things in to reinforce the fort so the Southerners had no chance to take it, but he couldn't do it. Our spies were too much on the ball. I saw that fleet leaving from New York Harbor, and although they didn't have a travel itinerary, they could put two and two together and get something close to four, and they knew exactly what was going on. The strange thing that is not well popularized, and you've got to look at the two volumes of Gustavus Fox letters, which were published in about 1917 to 1920, and a very limited edition was put out to just the naval officers in the Yankee Army, but as they died off, their descendants let them go into used bookstores and stuff, and now it's not too hard to get a hold of them. And I grabbed them and read, and I noted that he is recognizing, blaming Secretary of State Seward, when actually it was Lincoln's order. Lincoln secretly ordered the Powhatan to Pensacola, Florida. Gustavus Fox didn't know that. It had the tugboats and those 300 sailors on there were to guide those tugboats to lead the ships in to reinforce the fort. And Gustavus Fox had his hands tied. He could not reinforce the fort as the plan was because of Powhatan had been at the last minute, unknown to the commander of the fleet, Fox, ordered by Lincoln himself, down to Florida. So now Lincoln could send a fleet down, cause the Southerners, in reaction to that, to take the fort before the fleet could reinforce it and make it so that they could never take it, and yet tie the hands of the fleet so it couldn't reinforce the fort. Anderson said, as on the 8th of April, he got word that this reinforcing fleet was coming. Remember, the fleet sailed on the 6th. The Southerners cut the food off on the 7th. He said, "We shall strive to do our duty, though I frankly say that my heart is not in the war that I see is thus commenced." Major Anderson used the words of commencing the war by Lincoln sending the fleet. Rowan, commander of the Pawnee. The Pawnee was there and waiting for the Powhatan with its soldiers to show up. Gustavus Fox arrived on the morning of the 12th. He went on to the Pawnee and talked to Rowan and asked him to stand in at the bar. Rowan's response was, "I'm not going in there to inaugurate civil war." He backed out. He refused to go. Fox couldn't have reinforced the fort. He knew it. Rowan knew it. But Rowan finally was facing the facts that the fleet was inaugurating the war. Beauregard said, "It was manifestly an imperative necessity to reduce the fort as speedily as possible and not to wait until the ships and the fort could unite in a combined attack upon us." Jefferson Davis wrote, "At that time, the order for the sending of the fleet was a declaration of war. The responsibility is on their shoulders, not on ours. The juggle for position as to who shall fire the first shot at such an hour as this is unworthy of a great people and their cause. A deadly weapon has been aimed at our heart. Only a fool would wait until the first shot has been fired. The assault has been made." And so I say to you, the Southerners, in the name of good sense, had to reduce the fort or lose it forever. They had even offered to buy back the fort from the federal government. Lincoln wouldn't even listen to the liaison, wouldn't even recognize him, wouldn't allow any of his cabinet members to do it, but a sympathetic Supreme Court judge was permitted to be the liaison between the Lincoln administration and those people. So, shall we tolerate the statement that the South was wrong to fire on Sumter? In the name of common sense, it had no choice. If someone is swinging an axe at your throat, are you wrong to kick him in the stomach, to hit him in the jaw, to hit him in the chest, to shove him aside? No, you're simply defending your well-being. But there's yet another charge, a final charge. What about the charge that the South was wrong to oppose the North, the categoric charge? Well, the South was wrong to oppose the North. I don't think the South was fighting to preserve slavery. I do not think that the charge that the South was wrong to secede is valid at all. I do not think that the charge that the South was wrong to fire on Sumter is valid at all. What about the charge that the South was wrong to oppose the North? Jefferson Davis wrote, "We feel that our cause is just and holy. We profess solemnly in the face of mankind that we desire peace at any sacrifice save that of honor and independence. All we ask is to be let alone, that those who never held power over us shall not now attempt our subjugation by arms. This we must resist to the direst extremity." Davis is recognizing the South had to oppose the North. It had no other choice. Honor and independence demanded it. Lincoln, in his first inaugural address, says, "I have no purpose directly or indirectly to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so." A little later in that inaugural address, he says, "In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the momentous issue of civil war. The government will not assail you." Friends, dishonest Abe went back on his word. Dishonest Abe ordered an incredible fleet to reinforce Sumter. He refused the gentlemanly desires of the Southern liaison to obtain the fort by peaceable methods. This maniac, in self-contradiction, sent the fleet. He said later in that inaugural address, "There will be no invasion, no using of force against or among any people anywhere." But my friends, Sumter was leveled on the 12th, Virginia seceded on the 17th, I'm sorry, the 15th, or I'm sorry, Virginia seceded on the 17th, but Virginia had hung in there, not wanting to secede until the 15th. On the 15th of April, 2 days before Virginia seceded, Abraham Lincoln called for 75,000 Northern troops to march against the South and subject the South. That is aggression. And the Southerners fought to defend their homeland against that Northern aggression which Lincoln made in self-contradiction from his commitments in his inaugural address. And I submit to you that what happened to the South after the war and the Reconstruction era verified the fears that the Southerners had had as they looked at the election of 1860. Introducing Abraham Lincoln to the leadership of the states. Let me close by noting what Doughty notes. Doughty speaks of the Southerners' painful knowledge of what the North did with its military victory in contradistinction to the avowed purposes of the war, freedom and preservation of the Union. Doughty says, "As opposed to these noble abstractions, the Southerner had visited on him by the conquerors the very worst of all things he had feared from the beginning of his defense." And the reality of how the South was treated in the Reconstruction period verifies that these charges that the South fought to preserve slavery, it was wrong to secede, it was wrong to fire on Sumter, it was wrong to oppose the North, are invalid and unverified. The South lost its cause, but on the monument by Springwood Cemetery in Greenville, South Carolina, where I live, the Confederate monument, wherein are buried about 400 Confederate soldiers, on the south side of that beautiful monument, my favorite place in South Carolina, it says, "All lost, but by the graves where martyred heroes rest, he wins the most who honor says, success is not the test. The world shall yet decide in truth's clear far-off light that the soldiers who wore the gray and died with Lee were in the right." Ladies and gentlemen, I submit to you that this day in 1994 is a day in truth's clear, far-off light. It's time that the world decides that the soldiers that wore the gray and died with Lee were in the right. Thank you for your attention.